Fargo, the new virtual assistant from Wells Fargo, makes banking faster and easier. Like this.
Fargo, what's my checking account routing number?
And this.
Fargo, turn off my debit card.
And this.
Fargo, what did I spend on groceries last month?
And that's just the beginning. Do you Fargo? You can. In the Wells Fargo mobile app. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/getFargo.
Terms and conditions apply. Your mobile carrier's availability and message and data rates may apply. Wells Fargo Bank N.A. member FDIC.
Study and save this summer with Waubonsie Community College. Earn the same credit as a four-year school at a fraction of the cost. Choose from a variety of popular transferable courses, such as psychology, communications, art, biology, and economics, with many online and hybrid options. So study and save this summer at Waubonsie. Most classes start June 12. Learn more at waubonsie.edu/summer. That's waubonsie.edu/summer.
Welcome back to the ATL podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis. I'm sitting here. It's Friday. I'm sitting outside Augie's Cafe here in Westview, which is next door to the Slutty Vegan, which many of you have probably been to here over in West End / Westview. And why am I sitting in my car recording this? Because I wanted to get this episode out to you on a Friday. We already put out an episode this week, but I've been promising you Fridays, and so I want to get back on track. And so here we are with your Friday episode this week, and it is Alex Patterson with Beat the Bomb. Now, a lot of times businesses open and they're like, hey, we want to come in your show and talk about our business and blah, blah, blah. And I don't always say yes because it's like, you know, it just becomes like an advertisement for them. But I know Alex, as you'll find out, about 9 years, and I think he's got a fascinating story, and he built this company from scratch, and I'd known him in his previous life at Tough Mudder, which those of you who may be newer to the show don't understand or know that my first job or what I do kind of on a daily is for a company called Obstacle Racing Media, a podcast I started 10 years ago. And then go check out Obstacle Racing Media. It's what I've been doing for 10 years. And then about 5 years ago, I started this podcast because I wanted to do more Atlanta content. So that's how I met Alex. And I checked out the spot. And then I wanted to talk to him, and so we did. So we had a nice long chat, and I think he's a very cool guy, and it's a super cool concept. And I just love talking to, as you know, if you're following this show, sometimes it's a singer, sometimes it's an actor, sometimes it's an artist, sometimes it's a business owner. And I like to mix it up and give you different kinds of folks. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's what you're going to hear now. You're going to hear Alex Patterson from Beat the Bomb. Away we go. We have to back up. Not just from when I knew you, but from when before I knew you, because technically we've known each other about 10 years. It could be 9, right? Did you land at Tough Mudder at 12 or 13?
Well, I landed at Tough Mudder in 2010.
Oh, okay. Well, but then you can't touch that though. It's going to make noise. Then I've known you 10 years then, because my Tough Mudder experience started in 2012. So, but before that, I want to know like what you go to school for? Like, aren't you a fucking lawyer or something?
I guess technically I'm still a member of the New York State Bar.
Amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, but is that what you wanted to be? Like when you started college, were you on that path?
I mean, I don't know if I knew I was on a particular path, but I definitely liked law and sort of society, all things researching society. So yeah, I had been a high school debate guy, in addition to a bunch of other activities, and law seemed like it was going to be a good path. I still love law. I loved law school. Just a couple years of practicing, and then I moved into actually being Tough Mudder's first lawyer. So, and then kind of things went a different path. But you know, I actually tell people, if you really think about it, all law is completely made up. There's nothing written in stone about it. There's not, you know, the how many columns are needed to so a building doesn't collapse? Like, that's probably a formula you can work out. But whether someone should be in jail because they, you know, talked to someone else about a contract to kill a third party is just made up. Like, nothing happened to the third party, but they were planning something. So maybe they should be in jail. Maybe they shouldn't. Like, basically, law is completely creative. We're a bunch of animals who, you know, come from, I guess, caves in the woods, and law is the way that we all live together, drive together, have businesses together. So it's one of the most creative things you can have. Actually, the other day, someone said, "Hey, you're a lawyer. What's this beat the bomb thing?" I said, "Well, in a way, it's my own system of rules and punishments, and the punishments of paint bomb." So they're not; they are very different, but you know, there's some similar through themes.
I feel like that's all we should talk about. We shouldn't even talk about beat the bomb. If we're gonna go, I mean, that's really a deep conversation. Especially, so I had this guy in here yesterday who writes a lot about the city and politics and gentrification and all that stuff. And we had a really good conversation. Like, he's like no one wants to be preached to, and no one wants to talk to somebody who's too hard on either side. And so we had this great talk about that stuff. And I don't know whether you want to talk about this or not, but this is how this fucking, you know, you asked me what we're going to talk about. This is how it goes, dude. I just roll with it.
It's great.
And I said, for the first time in a while, I've thought about not voting. I said, I've been voting since I could vote. You know what I mean? Like, I've been voting since whatever that year that was, 92 or 94, right? I said, but I've always known, you know, it's crooked on both sides, but I'm finally at the point where I said, let me put it this way. So I have kids, right? And what I will tell my kids is, like when they say, like, well, the world's not fair, it's like, you're right. It's a system. Game's rigged. Now you can play in that system, or you can fight the system, right? And I think my days of fighting the system are mostly over, which is, I think, what happens when you hit 50, right? So I'm okay with that, right? Like, people who have all the money and the things make laws that help them keep the money and the things. That's not surprising.
Right.
So hearing you say this as someone who's actually studied it, like, hey, we're just making it up, right? So then the question will become, how do people start to swing the game back their way? Hire good lawyers?
Yeah, hire good lawyers. Go to community meetings, small donations, many of them. it's a big system, and it is rigged by the folks who have the money and who have the influence. But you know, thankfully, it's been relatively intelligently designed here in the U.S. in terms of splitting up. You know, the main focus of our political system is to try to prevent despotic rule over us, you know, arbitrarily by a particular person or one group. You could argue whether that, you know, has happened or not, but the separation of powers between the three branches of the federal government, the separation between the federal government and the states, you know, between states and localities, it's all meant to provide sort of a modicum of breathing room from being oppressed by any one particular. So actually through college, I studied a lot of, call it like how societies are set up and how our society's gotten to where it is, or I guess where it was in the late 1990s. But people's, you know, studying people who thought society should be very different and people who had different theories of how society worked, Karl Marx or, you know, others saying this is the fundamental operating system of society and this is why the following has to change.
So you're saying we, like, the whole point, because we forget that, oh, like, we left England because we said, hey, being ruled by one dude is not cool. So let's come up with these other ways.
Yeah, the founding fathers had a very keen understanding of human behavior. They didn't think that people were angels. They knew that they weren't. And then they created this system where there would be checked powers, you know, balance of powers sort of all around. I mean, in the beginning, they didn't even allow the populace to have sort of true democratic power. You know, that's why we have the electoral system of, you know, electors for voting for the president. It's why we have two senators for every state. That's not a representative, you know, truly representative system based on population. It's all sort of a big engineered experiment.
So did you answer a Craigslist ad, a job list ad, a LinkedIn ad for Tough Mudder in 2010?
Well, I'd been at a big law firm called Davis Polk, and I was looking to leave. It was the financial crisis, and I didn't like it there. I mean, there were things I liked about it. It's a great firm, but it wasn't for me. And then a friend of mine actually had seen Tough Mudder's very first New York Times article that was Playing with Fire, Barbed Wire, and Beer. It was a New York Times article in April 2010. And this friend and I had actually done a mud run in California in 2008. So I'd already done a mud run. It didn't have obstacles, but it was up and down hills. It was in San Diego, and there were showers afterwards and beers. So I kind of instinctively understood, oh, this is cool. And, you know, you throw some obstacles in the mix, it's even cooler. At the time, I was applying to a whole range of different things. My sort of job prospects were like a many forked road out ahead of me. I was very interested in automated vehicles and transportation. I was interested in politics and maybe working for a senator, governor, or congressman. I was looking at working at the FBI. And then sort of almost a bit on the lark, I said, oh, this Tough Mudder thing sounds really cool. It's really up my alley. We can talk later, but I have a background as a lifeguard. There's a lot of kind of teamwork skills and mentality coming from lifeguarding. And it seemed like that was sort of what the event was about. So yeah, threw my hat in the ring, and then met with the CEO, shortly thereafter. They had their first event. I actually wasn't at the first event because I think it was maybe like a week before I applied or 2 weeks before I applied. And they said, hey, we're going to be really busy, but let's do an interview after the first event. So shortly after the first event, interviewed, and then, yeah, got hired to be the company's attorney, at which time then I joined.
So the first event was PA, right? Mm-hmm. Where was the second event?
The second event was in Bear Creek out in California, up in the mountains near Tahoe.
That seems really crazy.
Was it Bear? It might have been Bear Valley. I think Bear Creek.
Bear Creek is the first one.
Bear Creek is the first one. Then there was Bear Valley. Then eventually, the next year we went to Snow Valley. So we always used to get confused.
No, but I'm saying that like you do your first event, you find this land in PA, and you're like, okay, cool, that worked. It seems like you don't want to have to then replicate that 3,000 miles across the country. You want to find a venue in New York or New Jersey or even Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time the thought was if this is going to be a scalable national concept, you kind of force yourself to put an event across the country. That means you're going to have to think harder about all the logistics and event planning than if it were just down the road from where you had done the first event. That said, I think probably practically there was a bit of a search for, at the time, the philosophy was like ski mountains, because ski mountains in summer don't have a lot going on. And you know, you can rent them and you can run up and down trails that are already made. So that's where the first two were ski mountains. I think that was kind of the philosophy. So talk to almost everyone who owns a ski mountain, see who wants to do a Tough Mudder, I'm sure is how they found the second event. By the third event, we went to Raceway Park, New Jersey. And I think that's when the whole concept really kind of landed. I mean, it landed.
Just hearing you say Raceway Park, New Jersey warms my heart, by the way.
Yes. Old English town, New Jersey. Yeah, it's definitely kind of what was for a long while kind of the heart and soul of the Tough Mudder annual series. This sort of awesome mix of muddy tracks and up and down BMX hills. Sort of that event sort of had everything, and it got you really muddy. It had a lot of water. Yeah. Also, it was our first World's Toughest Mudder in 2011.
Right, and then. And then the next two as well in 12 and 13.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the World's Toughest Mudder, which is like the hardest core of the mudder community, like is there always less like, let's bring it back to Jersey. Like everyone's always saying that.
Yeah. It was an amazing venue to hold it. Also because it has this sort of big building overlooking the drag racing strip. And sort of from that high ground, you can sort of see nearly the whole course, which was really fun.
Right. So you're the company's attorney, but it's a startup. It's moving quick. How quick were you starting to get involved in like other things?
Well, pretty quickly. You know, a startup, you're going to work 50, 60 plus hours a week. So the amount of legal work there was actually to do, wasn't going to take my whole time. So what I started to do was sponsorship decks. Like, we wanted free beer. We wanted free t-shirts. We couldn't really afford to buy all that stuff. So we had to reach out to sponsors. And the goal was, hey, if we're going to do a nationwide event series, yeah, we want a beer sponsor. We want a t-shirt sponsor. We want a power bar type, you know, sponsor. So I started to write to all these folks. And when you're writing a sponsorship deck, you have to choose photos. And you have to essentially create, you know, you have to portray the vision of why, despite having three events in 1 year, 2010, we were going to have 14, then 35, then 60, and you know the sponsor wanted to get in early on this. So it's a marketing endeavor kind of at heart. You're throwing out taglines, again, you're choosing photos. So by virtue of doing this, I think with you know, the leadership of the company, they said, oh, Alex, you got a bit of a knack for, you know, going through the files and finding the photos that are really compelling. You have a knack for explaining the concept. You know, why don't you begin to move more towards marketing? And also what happened at the time was everyone had an event job. So I had, you know, I had a legal hat, you know, maybe I was doing sponsorship sales, but when I got to the event, I ended up being the person on the mic. So pre Sean Corvell,
right.
Who is, you know, the master and amazing. But I kind of started it off, and actually I started off being the MC because I was a lawyer. So funny to go from one to the other, but I wrote a speech that was essentially a big legal warning. And the reason was because at the time, like now you sign a waiver and it's all electronic and it's backed up somewhere in the cloud. But at the time you'd sign a waiver and we'd put it in a box. And if we lost that box, we would have lost your entire like legal waiver that you had signed. We called it the death waiver. I thought as a lawyer, you know what? What I want to do is I want to write a start line speech that says things like, you don't have to actually do this event if you don't want to. Or if you can't swim, don't jump in the water. Or, you know, watch out with the barbed wire. So I kind of wrote this speech, but I also made a bunch of it tongue-in-cheek. And we had a wedding DJ who was going to be our start line MC, partly because they brought all the, you know, MC-type gear, all the speakers.
Right.
And I was trying to coach him on how to say this speech. It was both serious, but also had to be funny.
Right.
And he pretty much said, dude, let me just run the music. Why don't you do the speech? So I was probably a little bit sleep deprived. I was like, fine, I'll do it. So that was our second event. I was the start line MC. So the kind of company leadership saw me talk to the mutters. And then I think between the two things of sort of the sponsorship sales, the choosing of photos, that, and then kind of talking to the mutters and actually be able to rile them up, it became clear that I had a good knack for sort of the marketing and what the brand was of Tough Mudder. I'm sort of from that then got more and more involved in marketing. And at the time, we didn't have money for competitor group. There's a competitor group magazine, Runner's World magazine. You know, we didn't have time. Didn't have money for those ads. We didn't have money for TV ads. So the only ads we could really afford was this, you know, new company at the time, not really new at the time, called Facebook. Facebook was just starting out their advertising platform. And you could do page-like ads. You could do ads at people who liked cross-country running or marathons or, you know, Merrell shoes or whatever. And so it was a pretty much self-serve little nascent platform. And I just raised my hand and I said, look, we don't have a marketing director. I can do this, you know, for now. And that's kind of the classic startup many hats. You're like, you know what, for the time being, until right. we get someone who really knows what they're doing, I can do this. So that's where I moved from, like, law into marketing.
It's funny because Sean still to this day every race says, if you can't swim, don't go in the water. Then he repeats it a third time, and the third time when he says you can't swim, then everybody says it, don't go in the water. So what hear you say is like hilarious that it comes from the very first speech.
He may have dropped a particular ending to that line, which is, and all of your friends are going to tell you to jump. You know why? Because your friends know you can't swim.
Right, we can't say that one anymore.
We can't say that one anymore, no.
So, you know, again, it's like so hard for people to remember like pre-social and what life is like. So, you know, for me, I had done a Warrior Dash in 2010. They came here, North Georgia. It was their third or fourth event. They had their first event the year before, I think, and then they did their first tour in 2010. And it was a fucking flyer. It was literally a piece of paper that my friend handed me. It was me and like four or five other guys. Like, this is a really manly event. We're going to jump in the mud. We're going to, you know, have the turkey leg. We're going to have beer. Let's go do it. And it was like, all right. And I was not in shape. I wasn't a runner. I was like, whatever, right? So we did it. And like, it's very basic, right? You go over a little cargo net, you jump over the tires and the car. And it was fun. And I got a picture and like, that was it. And I never thought about it again. It wasn't like, where can I get more of this? You know, fast forward to 2 years later and I start seeing the videos. And I know the video, I'd have to find it, but I know the one when I see it. And I kind of kept watching it over and over again. Like, can I do this? And the concept, when you're not a runner, the concept of running at the time, 10 to 12 miles, air quotes, is like, well, it may as well be 100. If you can't run a mile, 10 to 12 may as well be, right?
Right.
And so
out of the reach of possibility.
And so it was so scary to me, right? And, you know, there's fire coming out and there's these crazy shirtless dudes. I'm like, that's not me, right? So my friend said in the fall of 2011, I'm going to sign up for a Tough Mudder. There's one coming here in February of 2012. And I was like, well, you're fat and out of shape. You're more fat than I am. Right. If you're doing it, my friend Dominic, I'll have to give him a shout out. I go, Dominic, if you're doing it, I'm doing it. So when we did that event, and I always say, if it was a different day, I don't know if it would have changed my life. But the fact that we woke up and it was 28 degrees and I had to jump in the ice bath, which was the first or second obstacle, at maybe 35 degrees, like maybe it had warmed up a little, like that is a life changer. I'm like, it definitely does something to your DNA. You do something that looks impossible to you. You jump in ice, you come out, you didn't die, and you're like, fuck yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's which event was it?
So this is North Georgia, Washington, Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
And it was freezing. It was one of those things that was like, and we had signed up for the Sunday just because, like, whatever, let's do Sunday. And it turned out that Saturday was windier, but Sunday was colder. Everybody was like, which one did you do? And it's funny because, you know, that was – the ice bath is like – was obstacle like two or three. You had big barrels burning that we like stood by and warmed. But I remember literally thinking the rest of this is going to be great because I just did the hardest part.
Yeah.
Even though we'll jump in the water again, it won't have ice in it.
Yeah. You know, it's definitely a conscious decision to put that that obstacle early on. Not just for one, for the reason you're talking about, which is get a really hard thing out of the way first, and then for the rest of the course, it's a bit all downhill from there, you know, metaphorically speaking. But also, it was a great equalizer. No matter how many pull-ups you could do, how in shape you were for running, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 to 5 to 10 feet after that obstacle, everybody now was in the same boat. It was like an equalizer. It was a camaraderie builder because when you got out of that, you just looked at the person next to you and you're like, oh my God, how did we decide to do this? You know, there's no turning back now. You can't go to the parking lot wet. Okay, this is on. You know, it wasn't something that was at mile 11 right before the finish that, you know, you just had to do then get through, although the electric shock is that. But yeah, it was a great... That was an awesome obstacle. Dumpster full of ice.
Oh, you can't be messing with that. So it's funny because like so many people are afraid of the electric shock. I was far more scared of diving into that.
The Arctic enema. Well, at the time, in the beginning, we used to call it the Chernobyl jacuzzi.
Right. And I think
you put dye into it.
Right. And it was like green dye. I don't know if you changed it yet, but I am one of the few that do remember it was in fact called Chernobyl jacuzzi.
Yeah. We got sued by jacuzzi.
Are you being serious?
We're not sued. We got a letter that said, you know, we have our brand is jacuzzi and we have a trademark. You can't use it. We wrote back tongue in cheek that I don't think anyone's going to confuse the one for the other. Cause like, sort of possibility of confusion is one of the legal tests if you're using someone else's trademark. Like it's, you know, it's a dumpster full of ice. You are a nice hot, you know, you're literally the opposite. Like I even wrote back and said, why don't you sponsor it? And they're like, no, stop using it. So then, yeah, we came up with the name Arctic Enema.
That's funny. I never knew that part of the story. This is why it's good to talk to the lawyer. I never knew that part. I just thought sometimes obstacle names change over the years. And I did not know that was why. That's amazing. Most people wouldn't even know that jacuzzi is a brand name.
Right. It's sort of one of those like Q-tip style things. Maybe it's
Kleenex,
become
Coke.
Generic. Yeah.
Right. So I do that event. You jump off a couple of more things into really cold water. You do all these things and we froze our ass off. And it was definitely finishing, literally thinking, I can now do anything. Like I really had that feeling.
It was a really tough event too.
Right.
I believe on Saturday, well... I think on Saturday we might have somehow had a snafu with the water stations, and then people were just finishing like zombies. I think really dehydrated. I mean, you had to go through this portion of the woods that was up, down. I remember Nolan, who was our course director, said, I said, Nolan, how long is it for the run in the woods? Because we're clocking the whole event. How long is the run? He said, well, I couldn't really get the ATV back there, so I guesstimated. I'm like, oh my God.
Love it. Love it.
It could be 2 miles, 3 miles.
Right. So if it was, so if it was a 75 degree Georgia day, which it could have
changed your life.
Right. I might have had fun, yeah. But we'll never know, because all I know is I immediately was like, cool. I heard there's the Spartan thing. I want to do that next. What's Savage? What's, you know, then we're all in. We're all in. We start a Facebook group and we're all in. And for whatever reason, you know, I decided I'm going to now make this like my life, which is another story that I've told many times. But just again, to try to remind people that, you know, mud runs weren't a part of life. You know what I mean? They weren't
totally new.
And the running industry, you mentioned, fucking hated us.
Yeah, they didn't understand why people would do something. I mean, Tough Mudder was untimed. So it was a very different philosophy. It was about just getting to the end. And probably just the fear factor you had in your mind of, oh my God, can I do this? That was essentially the reason to do it. Fitness and stuff was a bit, for us, a bit secondary. But it was that sort of mental challenge. And you had people who were overcoming cancer, people who were, in wheelchairs, people who, might have been way out of shape, saying, hey, this is going to be a challenge for me to get from the start to the end. But mud runs were not a thing. Now you see them in all sorts of commercials, and it's obviously a big industry now.
Well, I still get excited. In the early days when there was a commercial, I would really get excited, but I still, when they use us in, you know, I almost had a tampon commercial. I don't think they've done that. Maybe they have,
yeah.
But something different things besides, I just remember like talking to people in our industry and not understanding. It's like, that they were, you know, because like these numbers were astronomical. They didn't, like, how are you getting 10,000 people,
yeah,
you know, to do one of these?
And it's an insight that the sort of very competitive, or at least timed events on paved roads were not necessarily the only way that you could run. And I think it was tapping into something a bit more primal, that you wanted to run outdoors. You wanted to be running through the woods. It's kind of a bit more tapped into your human nature than putting on. And we played with it. You know, we joked, we made fun of spandex. We made a t-shirt that said marathons are boring. We kind of played off that comparison to regular running events. And I think we got a lot of people who would never have considered a running event, because running is fitness, running is exercise. Running is calorie burning. Running is technical. Running is a watch and a heart rate monitor. It's performance based. It's a particular type of rational thinking applied to your physical fitness. And Tough Mudder, especially, I think Spartan Race was a bit more in the middle. We can kind of talk about that later. But I think Tough Mudder was very much just sort of like, hey, just throw all that stuff out the window. You have to get from the start to the end. If you're limping at the end, whatever, you just have to get to the finish line. It was much more of a challenge. We said it's not a race, but remember
it still says that.
Yeah, the pledge, Tough Mudder is not a race, but a challenge. And so that was just core to the brand. And I think that was what resonated with people.
But it's interesting to think about, again, you know, and I know you're not here to take all the credit and you're a humble cat, but just even think about this, you know, that tongue-in-cheek sort of style that Tough Mudder still has. Like, the obstacle racing community, kind of still look for that. If it ever got too serious, even though they've added competitive waves and competitive things over time, that tongue-in-cheek sort of, like, that is what the brand is. It's like, this is tough, but fun. We are going to kind of bust your balls. We're going to have some sexually inappropriate names. You know what I mean? Which, you know, is harder in 2022 than it was 10 years ago. But still, like, that core of you guys early on, that's just kind of part of, like, who you are and those people were like.
Yeah, definitely. There was, I think, you know, there was some English sense. The founders were English, and there's sort of a bit of an English sense of humor to it, kind of a, taking the piss out of you, so to speak.
Right.
You know, we put up a sign at the 3 mile mark saying "Warrior Dash Finish Line."
Right.
This is a Tough Mudder, so you have to keep running.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, there was a bit of sort of self mass mastication about, like, why am I doing this to myself? You know, so you had to lace it with humor.
Right. Like, remember you paid for this.
Like, remember you paid for this. Exactly. And you're like, why did I, it's like mile eight. Why did I pay for this? You know, we used to, I wanted to do something where we put a bus at the 5 mile mark that said, this bus will take you to 1 mile from the finish. And then anyone who got on it, we would just put them back at the start. Like, we just, we just wanted to mess with people's minds. Yeah, because you don't know what life throws at you, and it's kind of a team event. There's sort of this whole philosophy of life's tough, it's a challenge. You're kind of taking that and putting it into one day. Yeah, but just a bit of a gallows humor, I guess, to it of, shoot, you know, why am I doing this to myself? I think there's some explanation then for why sort of a spark. So Tough Mudder went very big, very quickly, very, you know, and everyone wanted in on it. It didn't quite provide the laddering structure of a Spartan race in that physical fitness way. So some of the keys to its success were also some of the keys to the challenges as it kept going year after year, because it, you know, throwing a bowling ball against pins is just fun. Boom, you hear a big crashing sound, they get knocked down. But bowling also needs the leagues, the pros, the kind of laddering for the people who are really into it, kind of that core of it. You need that sort of the step laddering to something more. And World's Toughest Mudder was a bit like that, but it's also just so extreme that there wasn't a sort of an on-ramp from the regular Tough Mudders to the World's Toughest Mudder.
But I think you guys really enjoyed the rivalry. It was a very, like, Coke versus Pepsi, Chevy versus Ford situation. And I think you feel like you both, Spartan and Mudder, which, by the way, are now one company. Hilarious, right? If you ever told me that was going to happen, I would have. There are many things that have happened. The first time you guys had timing chips for like a 10K, like I got some insight from someone that said that's coming next year. I said Tough Mudder is not going to time. They do World's Toughest, but they're not going to time. Like, anyway, at the time you both embraced, like, this is what, like, you guys were like, burpees are stupid, and they were like, you know, we're not a mud party, whatever the things were. But I'm really curious, like, all these years removed later, like, what it was like, just because it was like a battle. Like, you guys fought over venues and weekends. Yeah. And it was like you were both, you know, jumping into this new thing called Facebook. And I don't know, was it a conscious, like, okay, we know we don't have this, or maybe one day we'll do it.
Oh, with the timing and the competitive nature,
and like the three races that you're talking about, which, by the way, they both have now.
Yep, I think I'm trying to think. I mean, we always knew Spartan was a competitor. We definitely wanted to beat them. There was definitely a Coke Pepsi rivalry going on. They took the more fitness serious washboard abs, you know, pro team approach to it. We took the more sort of crazy obstacles, it's a challenge, World's Toughest Mudder was sort of a high point of our season. I think we realized after a while that it was a big jump from the couch to just do a Tough Mudder, and that having a laddering structure like how Spartan had the trifecta was smart, because you could basically inculcate in people, you know, develop them at the 3 mile level. I think we kind of were born out of this actual, the first real competitor for us was Warrior Dash. The year we had three events, they had 14. The year we had 14, they had like 35. We're basically always a year behind them in number of events. And we looked at their 3 mile event and sort of called it, you know, wimpy, short. And by contrast, Tough Mudder was this thing that was, you know, legitimately super tough. In fact, actually Warrior Dash then tried to do something called like Iron Warrior Dash that was like 19 miles just to be even tougher. But Tough Mudder, I think, had found the right place to be. If you want to be a mudder, and if you want to call yourself tough, there's this sort of, that's the right range, I think, to in order to achieve the purpose of the event for the people who are doing it. Kind of, you had never done a mud run, but you did this and it was life-changing. If it was 3 miles, it wouldn't have been. If it was 25 miles, it would have been way out of reach. I think, and actually in the early days, I think our first Tough Mudder was like 7 miles. Then we started pushing it. Then maybe we got to 13, 14, then we dialed it back. I think we kind of found our happy medium. But what Spartan Race did was smart with the point structure. And I think, honestly, I think Spartan Races has more of an American vibe. I think Americans are a bit more self-serious. I think actually the kind of British is a little bit more like, let's just, you know, show up early at the pub and at 7 a.m. And then, you know, we'll go to Tough Mudder.
Well, before the pub, they camp overnight over there.
They camp overnight. It's like a festival vibe. And I think with the founders being British, they were sort of born out of, and the brand sort of born out of this. It's about toughness. It, like, if you don't train, you're almost more of a Tough Mudder because you're making it tougher on yourself, you know, versus if you train, then of course you're going to be able to finish it. So what's the point if you already know you're going to finish it? Versus in America, people were making this the, I'm going to go to 24-hour fitness for the next 9 months so I could change my life, look great, do a Tough Mudder. I just think there was something about the American consumer that Spartan Race understood a bit, and maybe Tough Mudder didn't as much. I don't know. I mean, but Spartan Race, give them a lot of credit. They were very core. Like, I think we were more, in a lot of times, business-oriented, process-oriented, systems, scaling. I think we ran better, more professional events, I would say. Of course, I'm biased. But I think they had a bit more of the spirit of, hey, they were doing stuff because they just thought it was cool. Hurricane heats, and they would make it part of... So I think, you know, there's a... probably more to talk about why they ended up buying Tough Mudder and how that worked out, because I would have hoped and predicted it would have been
the other way around.
But yeah, from a business perspective, I think it kind of makes sense to have one sort of obstacle course mud run company. I think the market, while big, is only so big. I think we even knew in the beginning, hey, there's probably going to be one company that really survives to do a nationwide series of mud runs. It will be a company that has the logistics to do it, where everything becomes more efficient. And we just were like, it's going to be us. It kind of turned out, I guess, to be the opposite. Although it makes sense for both brands to still be alive.
Yeah. And so without getting too much into that, because there's some messy stuff there, I do want to talk about the idea of, like, I've seen under the hood of both companies, right? So I know everybody's dirty laundry, which is like, you know, I'm just, it's good to have the information. You know, I'm a journalist and somebody that interviews people. So I've, you know, I know what I can talk about on the record and off, but just to say that you were a much more fine-tuned machine. Tough Mudder did have all these logistics down. Spartan puts on a great event. And then past that, they've had more issues, let's just say internally. So, there's probably another universe where it did go the other way. If things went a certain way, you know, buying Tough Mudder, and again, we don't have to get too into this, buying Tough Mudder, many would have said to Joe, like, isn't a smart idea at the time, but it was like this ego place of, I'm going to win the war. And if I buy Tough Mudder, I've won the war, even if they're losing me money now or et cetera. But that's a much longer story for another time. And you are hitting on one of the topics that I want to get to about Beat the Bomb and how you attract more audience. But let's back up a little bit to the segue of how you got from one to the other. Were you in a place of, I know I got to do something next, I don't know what it is, and then you found the concept? Or was it you figured out the concept and then, like, decided, okay, I'm going to get out of here?
I think it was more, you know, in the true Tough Mudder spirit of what's the next obstacle. I had been at Tough Mudder for 5 years, from 2010 to early 2015. And so a lot of the stuff that we're talking about happened years after I left, what we were just talking about in terms of the brands, you know, becoming into one company. And so, you know, I had been there for 5 seasons. And had a bunch of different hats in the company. I'd been lawyer, I'd been the head of marketing, I'd been called chief creative officer and made up obstacles and helped design courses. Then I was chief culture officer, which was basically a lot of hiring and internal discussions about people issues, which is where, just got a little segue here, but in the beginning you think, especially with a lawyer mentality, that to start a company means, like, literally incorporating it. Okay, that is somewhat true. And then you need to market it, because before you almost even create what someone's going to buy, you need to begin to conceptualize it and sell it and see if it's going to have any resonance. So marketing is really important. Then you sort of think that the product actually is the most important thing, because you can't market something that people hate and that sucks. So you really should spend your time on the product. So again, you should really spend your time on setting up the company, because you can't make a company if you don't have a legal entity. Yes. You really need to spend the time marketing and conceptualizing it. Yes. Okay, then you really need to spend your time on the product itself. And then you kind of reach this point where you say, actually, it's the company and it's the people there that are the most important thing, because the people make the product leads to the marketing of it, and you know, the legal stuff all kind of falls into place. So kind of I'd had this journey from law and the company to marketing to working on the product to working on the people, realizing the people are the most important thing. And it seemed like, okay, my next step after being here 5 years was, it's time to create my own company. Something that you know, I can create. It was sort of the next challenge. I had been right next to the founders and leaders of the company, and rather than sort of taking the next 5 years and sort of living it out at Tough Mudder, I think I was like 35. It's like, well, I could, you know, spend 35 to 40 staying at Tough Mudder, a place I felt I had helped build, or I can kind of almost like jumping into Arctic Enema. I can sort of have this moment. Let me try myself. Like, let me jump into something that's potentially much worse, much more challenging. But when I come out the other side of it, like you, I'll be a different person. Because I thought, I'm not going to be a different person if I stay here for 5 years. And that kind of challenge of what's the next obstacle was what spurred me to say, it's time to leave Tough Mudder. I, you know, love the company, love the place. And then I started a search of, okay, what's it going to be? And I started with this concept called Task Force Zero. And it was born from, while I had been going to many, many Tough Mudders, I'd begun adding to my weekends to do things like taking a glider trip.
Oh my God, I just remembered this. It's funny because when we had coffee, when Jesse and I had coffee, he mentioned it and I forgot. Like, you and I were on the phone about this. Mm. Like, I was going to send someone
to
like
a Task Force Zero event.
Hey, can you send, we want to do, like, I just want to invite a few friends. What do you call it? Like, not a soft launch, but like a beta event.
Yeah.
Like one weekend we take, you don't know what we're going to do. Maybe 1 week we go skydiving. Maybe 1 week we go throw right. axes. Like,
right. It was a bit of a,
it's so funny. I forgot all about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. It's so people, you know, you can give a soundbite as to what, why did I create Beat the Bomb? You know, you could give a soundbite of, I grew up playing video games, but also being into sports. And this is like esports meets video games. And you could sort of say, but the actual path is a little bit different. It was, hey, I have such a Tough Mudder mentality on about teamwork, group activities. You know, I'd made all these obstacles where the fundamental thing about the obstacle is you get to it, and now you got to talk with your teammates about how to get over it. The best obstacles I thought would be team obstacles that had to do with communication. So I kind of coming out of this, and yet I had seen, I knew that Tough Mudder had a problem, which is a lot of people were going to do it once and then weren't going to do it again. And yet we had the email addresses and we kind of understood the mentality of this whole sort of swath of people, this whole kind of generation of age and stage type folks. You know, one thing I thought we really should do would be fitness for them. Another thing I thought would be kind of other types of experiential events that they might buy. And so I think, you know, we'd also developed something called the Mudder Legion. That was the repeater program where if you did one event, you got this headband, two events, you got that headband. So I just began to think of what if there was sort of this weekend club, almost a called Task Force Zero, where you would sign up to events and you'd show up, but you wouldn't know what we would be doing that day. Maybe you would go axe throwing or learn how to you know, shoot a weapon at a gun range or learn how to ride a motorcycle, or you go skydiving that day. The kind of stuff that, you know, you might want to do in your life, like check off certain boxes, but just to organize it and to do it by yourself versus if it were like a club. At the time, like ClassPass was a thing and people were kind of buying subscriptions. And I thought, well, maybe you kind of create this subscription club of folks who are up for whatever, you know, and kind of me understanding that the Tough Mudder mentality wasn't solely that people wanted to do a mud run. It was that they wanted to, they were like up to do this thing that was challenging and kind of, let's just freaking do that. So I thought you could create a brand around that. But I was, at the time, I was kind of coming as if I still worked at Tough Mudder, as if what we were creating was an adjacent business that if we did, you know, 700,000 participants on a year might be something that 50,000 of them would want to be. I was just sort of coming too much from a place of where I had just been. So I trialed a bunch of those events. We had a great time, but I didn't think that it was going to be a great business. You got 10 people in a van. You needed a driver. You needed to drive around to all these different places. Like we went, flew helicopters, went to a gun range, did a jiu-jitsu lesson one day. Another trip was we rode motorcycles. We did rock climbing outside. I just thought, okay, you know, basically being a trip provider, wasn't going to be a great business. And frankly, like once it got out, what was on the trips, any of the
secrecy of it would be ruined. Traffic can ruin your itinerary.
Right.
And just it wasn't going to be that scalable. You'd have to have lots and lots of vans, lots of events. Then I thought about, well, maybe I'll create more of just a class pass for rather than join a gym for $59 a month or $99 a month, you could, you know, accumulate points towards some sort of action sports club, and those points would be redeemable at these places. Anyway, it just began to sort of morph. On our Task Force Zero trips, we brought this briefcase. It was part of how I would have people pass the time in the van between one activity to the next. And in the briefcase, I'd made everyone fill out like a dossier about themselves, where they're from, their, you know, their birth date, their favorite X, Y, and Z. And in the van, you'd have to memorize what was in the briefcase. And when you got out of the van to the next activity, showed up in the parking lot of a motorcycle training facility, you would have to, we would quiz you. And if you failed, you would do push-ups. Very, you know, tough mudder-esque. You do push-ups, burpees, or something like that. So kind of in my mind, I began to think about this other type of event, almost like, you know, you've ever watched 24 with Jack Bauer, Kiefer Sutherland, Homeland, Die Hard. I began to think of this almost kind of city-based challenge where you got a briefcase, and in the briefcase was a series of assignments. In fact, actually, one of our Task Force Zero trips, I met. It was, in retrospect, it was very stupid to be essentially giving someone a briefcase in the middle of Grand Central Station. But I had everyone meet me in Grand Central Station. I gave them a metal briefcase. It looked like a illegal activity. And then they opened the briefcase, and it said, "The van is within a 5-mile radius. Here's a bunch of walkie-talkies. The team needs to find the van."
Oh, it's a great start. Right?
It was fun. So that was a great start to that event. I mean, it sort of morphed to say, well, you know, maybe I'll do something that's almost like a chain of not like a series of escape room rooms. You get a briefcase, you go to location one. There you get a briefing from like a immersive actor kind of person. Then you go to location two, which might be a hotel room you have to ransack to find a thumb drive. Maybe location three is an interrogation you're watching happening. And then in my mind, location four was you're trying to disarm a bomb before it goes off. And I thought, how is it going to be fun? How's it going to be this really incredible ending? Well, we'll put you in like these white hazmat suits, and the bomb you're trying to disarm will be a paint bomb. And if you fail, it'll go off, and then you'll get all these photos like what? Like Color Run. Because we had, you know, watched Color Run forever. And, you know, growing up watching Nickelodeon shows, Double Dare, et cetera, getting slimed, getting... But there was this, okay, I just come from something that was ticketed, really played well on social media, was a challenge. So I thought of this concept, and I called it the briefcase game. So you have the briefcase of the game. Then I began looking into renting multiple locations, having actors, you know, at each one.
Right.
And actually through this process, I began to do a lot of escape rooms. And I realized that escape rooms kind of already had this concept of an immersive multi-room experience that was very heavily themed. Some of them were spy espionage or find the killer or, you know, you're in a jail cell locked in. I thought, okay, well, looks like I'm kind of meandering my way to a market that already exists, escape rooms, that people are already doing pretty well. And I'm not a kind of copycat person. So, like, am I going to really kind of copy what these people are doing? I went to immersive theater in New York City. I sort of started to see some of the problems with, I thought maybe you could do this in a town, like a city that had a lot of actors. Just then I actually looked into, just started to do some of my legal research. And I realized it would be going to be really hard to get any kind of insurance for an activity that had people go from location A to B to C. And I remember one insurance agent telling me, look, if they're going from location A to B and they decide that on the way, like if you're, you know, having them walk 5 blocks in New York City, you know, they want to go to Starbucks, they cross the street, they get hit by a car, we can't insure that. It has to be essentially under one roof. And that's, so I began to sort of develop, well, you know, instead of having 5 different locations, what if it's 5 rooms in a sequence? And I did dozens of escape rooms. I went to an escape room convention. I can get into later how I signed myself up for like a tech camp, summer camp at NYU. But I began to think, okay, the problems with escape rooms, I started to see the problems as I did escape rooms. Like there's scenic and set design exercises. There's scenic and set design companies. People break things in the rooms. you need a human to come in and reset the rooms. All the clues and locks and puzzles, once someone opens the locks and doors, you have to have a human come in and reset it. Once you do an escape room, you can never do it again because you know where all the clues are. So how do you invite your friends to come and do something if you can't actually do the same thing that you did? Maybe you invite them to do a different room. So every escape room owner needs multiple different themed rooms. Once they have lots of locations, 5, 10 more, now all their free cash flow needs to be reinvested in upgrading their rooms, changing a jail cell room to a submarine room, changing a killer's basement room into a cabin in the woods. So there's kind of a asymptotic element to their ability to scale, because as they get bigger, it's harder and harder to scale.
I've never heard that word before.
Well, like in an asymptote, it goes like there's only they can only go so high because first they get their logistics stretched because maybe they have a factory in Kentucky that makes all of their props, so they're more of a Midwest company, and so they can't really be national. They're harder to be global. So what are the ways to solve? And actually, another thing is they're just so anticlimactic. When you don't get out of an escape room, the attendant comes in and opens a door and says, "You guys can leave now." I'm like, so I started thinking, if I were to do an escape room company, it's got to be something.
Right.
Like I would lock them in for the next hour in the dark or something. Like, okay, lights out, or maybe just have like really bad music playing. But okay, it's not exciting, this ending. It's also not shareable. You can't take any photos because then it would ruin it for the next person if you posted these. So all these problems with an escape room, they're really fun. There's hundreds of people. There's thousands of escape rooms in the country. How do we just unpack this and make a better mousetrap? Well, number one, you start by making it digital. You can reprogram the rooms if they're touchscreens, RFID readers, technology that knows where you're standing in the room, projection screens. So don't make it about physical set design. Make it technological. Then make it highly social media share-worthy by creating like this paint bomb of an ending. And change the gameplay from most escape rooms are very nerdy. They're very, they're very mental. There's a clock on the wall. There's a map on the wall. There might be a calendar on the wall. There might be books with certain pages turned over. All these things relate to each other. But that's really hard to do as a team. But I'd come from a place where you might have to lift a human over a wall,
right,
which is something you do as a team. So I looked at escape room play and I said, you put all these people in a room, but they're fundamentally doing an activity that is antisocial, that's very mental. You can't do, for example, like a math test. You can't do it as a group. You can sit in a room and each do the same math test. Hard to do that as a group. So I began to think, you need to make games that make people work together. And I started to think of, the old game Simon, where you sit around and there's the yellow, red, green, and blue buttons, and it goes deet doot, deet doot, deet doot, and you have to recreate the pattern. I just took a Simon and I had four friends and I said, look, we each get one color. Let's try to play this game. And it was hilarious. And so I just began to think of games that you had to do as a group that would be really fun if you broke them down and gave everybody a different piece of the action. And so that's how kind of the Beat the Bomb games were born. They were extremely social, sort of hearkening to Tough Mudder obstacles, but now you have it in a box in a city that can be in any city in the world. It's, in my view, a better idea than Tough Mudder in that it can be much more scalable, much more global.
So all of that is true. I went to mine. I loved it. But the word that keeps coming up to me when you talk about the version you make is expensive. Tech is expensive, right? It breaks. You got to program it. You got to put it in every location. So talk to me about how that's scalable, or how you overcome that piece.
Well, I mean, I think in general, although your CTO will want the newest computer always, in general, the cost of this type of technology is going to come down. Like the cost of a touchscreen, the cost of a LCD screen, over the last 10 years has come down. Not to say we won't kind of continually want the latest and greatest. But I think the cost of the stuff that we're working with should come down. The pandemic did put a little bit of a twist in that, where due to supply chain stuff, everything you're buying is more expensive than it was even in 2017-18. But technology is the building blocks of the future. I mean, we're in a room here, and there's more technology probably than there was in NASA, in 1970. We have like 2-3 IMAX, and
that's a great point, sir.
Yeah, I think eventually, our brand, you can go to a Beat the Bomb and sort of experience the best and latest in technology, but this is going to be kind of like at the forefront of mud runs. Now there's people putting on mud runs in all sorts of different shapes and forms. This type of immersive digital game room is a type of socializing that's here to stay. And then look, it's scale. You know, once we're about to do our second and third location. We just opened Atlanta. We're opening DC in January. When we begin to do 6 of these a year, 16 of these a year, you can buy in bulk, you can pre-program everything. And it's much easier than doing it with an escape room where you need CNC machines and expert builders. It's any place in America or the world, you can hang a TV monitor straight in a corporate conference room. We actually have a company here that we're working with that does all the corporate office work in Atlanta, and they're basically putting all of our technology in place. And the theory there is there's one of them in every city.
Right.
So you get that company to help you set it all up.
Right, like you found a company to build all the tables, right?
Oh, yeah, all of our tables and stuff. We found a company to build all of that.
Right.
But the cool thing is you plug in the computers, you hit the switch, and now Beat the Bomb is alive.
So what I really enjoyed and appreciated, I think the most, because I'm not an escape room guy. It's nothing I've thought to want to do. I think I'm almost ready to go with my whole family. Like, I could go with like my wife and my one son who's 13 and my daughter who's 15. My littlest is 9. So it's like, it could be fun, but I think he would love it. He would love all the lighted up parts of it. But I'm just saying, like, I've never been like, let's go do that for my family. Like, we do the pumpkin patch thing every fall, and that's become like our family thing. We've got tradition around this one location. But I've never done that. And I know there are people, my friend Gary, who goes to them everywhere he fucking goes. Like, every city, he's going to go to the escape. He's doing the things. I'm not one of those guys. So you're telling me all these things, and even when you're giving me the tour, honestly, it's all going over my head. It's like trying to, it's honestly like trying to explain to somebody, hey, when you jump in this, you're going to be cold. It doesn't really do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then we start it. And I think the part that impressed me the most is because you're like, even just explaining the basics of, because I said, what if they don't figure it out? You're like, no, it's 10 minutes and they get to whatever level they get to. I didn't even understand the concept of levels. But in that very first room, which is the dials and switches, it's the human version of
We call it Hack Attack.
Right, but it's the human version of that game above Among Us, basically, the tasks in Among Us.
Yep.
And you start doing it, and you realize that the instructions for one are on the other side of another wall. But then when you get past that level, now you've got multiple instructions to go to multiple things. And so even that alone, I was like, well, this is really fucking smart of how they did this. Then you go to the next one, which was – what's the second one?
The second room
is lasers.
Lasers, yeah, lasers.
And so you're like, okay, it's lasers. But then you come up with these different ways of not just where the lasers are, but oh, one person can stop the laser. Like each level of things, the human version of Simon, where you get kind of right away, okay, this is Simon. But then by the fourth or fifth level, it's like question mark instead of a symbol. Right. Like that shit's genius, dude. I mean, that's real. Is that all you, or is that you and a team?
We have a great team, and we bop around a lot of ideas. I mean, you know, for sure, the inspiration of the concept and the games have come from my mind, but we have, you know, great game developers that come up with their own ideas, push me on it. But the philosophy, we're kind of all aligned on this philosophy of games that are hyper-social, that really make you work together and that throw twists at you. The game really is about learning to play the game. So you start and you know how to play it, or you know, you get a little bit of instructions and you kind of learn your way into playing it. You get a little bit comfortable. And then there's, we call it a gotcha or a twist. You know, then something happens where an assumption you had now is taken away.
Like fireballs.
Right. So we have a game called Floor Grid where you move around the room and stand on symbols that you're assigned. Well, at some point then, fireballs start crossing through, and you now need to avoid the fireballs before you can step on your shapes. And if everyone is not on that plan, then you will just keep losing that level. I mean, that's the thing. At Beat the Bomb, everyone needs to understand what's going on. There's no wallflowers. Everyone's a participant. You know, like if you're trying to lift people over tough mud or obstacle and someone's not pulling their weight, you know, the pyramid's going to topple. So we wanted to make games that were functioning like that. So for example, as you know now, our last game, Cyberbot, you're driving a bomb robot through a maze on a TV screen in a video game, and every player has a different control over that cyberbot. It's a little bit like a Pac-Man game driving this thing through a maze. So, but someone has left, someone has right, someone has forward, someone has the map to show where you're going, someone has aim, and someone has shoot, and you all need to work together. And the buttons or the controls are indistinguishable when you start out the game. So the very first thing you need to do is figure out what each control does, and then you can start to play the game from there. Who has left? Who has right? Of course, if everyone's squeezing, I don't want to give away some strategy here, but you know, if everyone's squeezing their buttons at the same time, it's hard to know what each one does. Same in the sound game. If everyone's tapping their RFID reader, how do you know what your tap actually just did? So from the very first, you have to say, we need a strategy to even learn how this game works.
Right,
and then over time, it changes.
Right, and I think that concept, by the time you get to the last round, the bomb round, you've started to work better as a team. So you might even think that ahead of time where you wouldn't have last time. Hey, before we do anything, let's figure out who's who. Like, it costs us a few seconds, but it's okay. Like, you've learned that sort of skill.
Yeah. I don't want to get too – I mean, there's a lot that you can get deep on, but, like, each of us is born into this world, and we're like one of those buttons. We don't really know what we do. And then over time, you got to figure out what you're good at, what you do, what's your role, you know. So, and, yeah, there's a lot about Beat the Bomb that is about teaching people to work together. These games teach you to come together as a group. And as you say, what's really fun is that five games in that last and final game – you are driving this robot around a maze as if you're one person with one mind and one controller, but you're actually a group of four people, five people, six people. It's just incredible to watch that teamwork. Now, we do make it where it's very unlikely for you to have earned enough time through the first four games to actually beat the bomb. 90% of people fail because it's always fun to get the paint splatter on you. But that feeling of achievement and the sense of, you know what, we learned enough, we're a good enough team now. If we came back, we might be able to beat this thing,
right?
Is what people are left with.
I have to say that was my entire – when I realized we were going to – when we beat it, I have to say that was a
you
huge
did beat it.
Was
yeah.
a huge, huge point of pride. And obviously not just me, but like my really good team. But I was telling you after the event, they were so happy that they were doing like so well. Like they were like, oh wow, like we didn't think we did, like we're so programmed around failure and you did it wrong. It's like, wait, actually getting this far means we did pretty good.
Yeah, your team did great.
But they were so excited about it. Like they were lit up about it.
Yeah, I mean working together and then achieving a common goal totally lights you up in a way that doing it individually doesn't. As we were chatting here, I was sort of drawing parallels to the law idea of needing to work together, of you have a challenge and you need to work together with other people. And isn't that also, it's kind of like society in a box in a way.
Right.
Five, six different people, different ideas, different minds, common challenge, things getting thrown at you. We see a lot of school groups come out. I think it's their teachers play Beat the Bomb probably with just guy friends, girlfriends, date nights, couples. And then they say, oh my God, this would actually be really valuable for our kids.
Right.
And they call us up and book, you know, an 80-person school group, show up in the yellow buses, and we put all the school kids through. And we're teaching them the sort of skills of working together. I always also thought, like, I was a pretty good student growing up. And mostly being a student is an individual exercise, you know, most of school, maybe until you get to later stages of school when you're working on group projects and stuff. But, you know, you're asked to memorize information, put it back on a test. You know, you get an A. As an individual, you get an A, but the person next to you may get a B. But it's in sports where you don't get an individual grade if you're on a team sport. You lose as a soccer team or you win as a soccer team or as a basketball team. I was in a brass choir. And I was a trumpet player. So you always are listening to the cues of everyone else. So the trombone player goes, you know, boop, 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 boop. And then you have to go, dee, 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 dee. And you're listening to the cues. Theater as well. You know, when is it your time to come from stage left? You know, get onto the stage and say, where art thou, Romeo? It's about cues, about working together. It's about noticing and finding your place.
You're such a Renaissance man. Who knew, Alex?
I know. thanks.
Well, Matt, you actually just gave me a great idea, though, because my kid's school is a charter school, and they have, like, I think, like, my first thought was, oh, like the STEAM kids or whatever, the kids that do the tech. But also, I think they could bring a whole grade, like a whole class.
Yeah.
So we need to talk because I can make some phone calls, and that would be super cool.
Oh, that'd be great.
My kids would probably probably have more fun with their friends or their classmates than me and mom. Even though I do kind of like the idea of doing, like, I don't.
It's a fun thing as a family.
No,
right?
it does seem fun.
But I haven't done it yet as a family. Yeah, but there are very few activities that actually you can be engaged as a family, like, you know, maybe taking your kids camping in the woods and saying no cell phones or something. But this is one of those activities you can bring as a group. But they
good luck with that, by the way.
Fun.
Good luck with telling your kids no cell phones.
Yeah, right.
So now we're back to this question of scale, and it's the question that we've already talked about offline, but that I want to talk to you about here. And how do we solve the same problem that Tough Mudder and Spartan ran into if we've marketed a thing and said, this is this great, super fun thing, and it's out of your comfort zone, and it's not norm, all the things that we say, and then they do it once, and there are plenty of people that go, let's do it again, let's try the next phrase. But there's plenty of people that are going to go, I did that already.
Yeah, I think it's a mix. I mean, first, the concept's been built to be reprogrammable. So the game rooms that we were talking about, and I guess anyone listening, unless they've Googled it, Beat the Bomb is the core experience is 5 rooms in a row. A 10 by 10 room, 10 by 20, 10 by 10, 10 by 20.
We
did. Okay, cool. But the technology in the rooms, you can reprogram. So you could come back tomorrow and play Mission 2. It'd be a different set of 5 games through the very same 5 rooms. And you would actually, in order to face you with something different at the end, you'd be wearing a black suit, not a white suit. And you'd be hitting, you'd get hit with foam, not paint. As a second
end. What if I want foam, though? Foam? I mean, what if I want paint again?
If you want paint again, you can play Mission 1 again. And what we're going to be starting to do is, you go to a salad shop and you can get the harvest salad, or you can get the, you know, summer salad or something, or you can make your own. So we have a game library. Each one of these games in each room is just is a game that we've made up. So if you ever want to come in and create your own game set, you can, because it's all, so it being digital really changes the game. It allows us to do things like, if you were to come back, we could set the game at the very place you left off. So if there's 50 levels and you got to level 7, you can come back and start at level 7.
I like that idea a lot. I like that idea.
So it being digital, it being a video game, gives it a much different ability. Like you talked about bringing your kids or their school. We could set it to 6th grade level, 7th grade level, 8th grade level. It's a video game. We can program it to different difficulty levels. We have a battle mode. So this is what's really – battle mode is really fun. You basically start in 2 different rooms, and whichever team does better wins that room, and it gives you an advantage to the end. But if you've ever played Laser Maze for 10 minutes and then lost that game, so all of your effort went for naught, you're just really cursing, and you hear the other team shouting out of joy. So – you know, there's a lot of things like throwing a ball through a hoop that's 10 feet above your head that, you know, you'd really get tired of after, you know, a few hours or minutes or whatever, minutes or hours. But once it's competitive, now there's a reason to keep doing it, even though it's this very same thing. So where we're moving with all these digital room-based games, I think, is towards a competitive. So in some ways, what Beat the Bomb is now is a little bit where the Tough Mudder footing was. It's a challenge for you to get to the end with your team and try to do it. But where we will move with it is towards maybe more that Spartan Race footing, which is it's a competition. There's performance goals, and you can keep coming back and playing it in different ways.
What are the demographics on it? I'm guessing I'm on the older side.
I'd like to disabuse you of that notion, but you are in fact correct. It's generally a 25 to 35 year old majority female buyer demographic. It's about 55-45 female male in terms of players. So
really,
more even there. You might think it's a video game thing, so it might skew more male, but females play lots of video games, and it's just a. When you put in, we do the Instagram and TikTokable nature better than Museum of Ice Cream or Candytopia or these other, you know, at the end, the bomb room becomes a photo booth where you get an amazing slow motion video of you getting paint blasted. Then you get photos with your whole team. And it's just such a social experience. In our experience, it's a lot of females who are the ones getting groups together. Either getting the guys and girls together or just a big group of girlfriends on a night out to come on out. So that's a big, that's sort of the main, I'd say, core. But then we get about 20% as corporate groups. About 20% are under 18s in school groups. So it's really, and we get families. It's really wide. No one's done this yet. I wasn't there when bowling was invented, but I imagine the original thing was, hey, there's this place where you roll this thing and there's a, you know, you knock over all these pins and it's really fun. It didn't have like a tag on it yet. It was just, wow, that's kind of a fun, cool thing. Let's go do that. That's where we are.
Right. What if we give them pizza and beer too while we do that?
Well, that was enough. I was going to say that, so thanks for bringing it up. Another way to make this a more repeatable experience is you make it a bar with some great bites to eat. So you might do an experiential thing once, but if there's a really fun, awesome, cool video game type bar in your city, that's something you can do multiple times a year, especially when you're getting an email saying we have a new game set or we have a pro league tournament we have this or that promotion. It's like, oh, cool. I'll come back. We'll make a night out of it. They have food. They have drinks. We also, in order to support the food and drinks and just progress the concept, we took our enclosed game rooms that are 10 foot by 10 foot or 10 foot by 20, and we essentially made a 10 foot by 15 foot game area without a back wall. So it's a three-walled area. In some ways, it looks like a squash court. And it wouldn't surprise you that I grew up playing a little bit of squash. I'm bad at it. I have a twin brother, so you can go deep on the whole teamwork element of that and why that's become a life focus of sharing, working together. I am a twin, but he was a great squash player. But anyway, it kind of looks like a squash court. It has a front wall that's projection. It has three touch screens on either side with an RFID reader underneath them. And we can play, save for the Laser Maze games, because it's not an enclosed box, but we can play every other game that the company makes. And we've also made a whole host of other games, short format games that are 2 to 5 minutes. I mean, we call it our game bay. And in the game bay, whereas the mission games, you work together. You go into an enclosed room, you work together to try to earn time for your bomb clock. In the game bay, we have formats that are 3 versus 3 in the room. We have formats that are 1 versus 1 versus 1 versus 1, basically every person for themselves. It's really expanded what we can do from a game. We can really almost make any type of game. So, for example, one of our games is called Ejection Seat, and it's a little bit like a take on musical chairs. Everyone has an RFID wristband, and there's these readers around the room. Let's say we're a team of six or a group of six at this point, because it's not really a team thing anymore. And then five of the readers light up, and you have to